You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Brewer. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And joining us once again, the Oracle of Cycling, Lizzie Banks.
Hello, Richard and Lionel.
Lizzie, hello. You've had a busy day, Lizzie.
I have had a busy day. It wasn't planned at all, but somehow I found myself at Preston bus station.
That's extraordinary.
People won't believe this.
How do you accidentally find yourself at Preston bus station?
I can't quite explain it myself, but, you know, I actually found myself having a tapas lunch in Preston and parking at Preston bus station, which is really quite unbelievable. And no, it wasn't planned at all, but I was travelling and I begun to get very, very, very hungry. We couldn't find anywhere good to eat. And then we were very close to Preston, so we thought, why not? Just go to Preston bus station and see if we can find some lunch.
Obvious question. Why not a butter pie? Why tapas? I mean, a tapas could have welter, of course, but...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I was Googling where was good to eat in Preston, and then I Googled tapas, and the first thing that came up was a picture of chips and a baguette. So we didn't go there. But no, I thought I would get in the spirit of the welter and go to the very highly rated tapas restaurant in Preston.
For anyone listening to the Cycling Podcast for the first time and wondering what on earth is going on, Hugh Carthy, who is going very well in the GC, is from Preston.
Lizzie, was Preston buzzing with talk of Hugh Carthy and how he's getting on at the Vuelta?
You know what? When I was driving into Preston, the traffic was rammed, and I could only assume it was because everybody was driving to the bus station. I didn't see any Hugh Carthy flags or signs around Preston, which was quite disappointing. But Preston was quite busy, which is surprising, seeing as it's in a lockdown, but no one there seemed to realise.
Oh well. This is an escape from all talk of lockdown, isn't it? We are a refuge from that for everybody, anywhere who might be finding that their freedoms are being restricted once again. But the Vuelta goes on. And what are the headlines today, Lionel? We had a mountain stage today, and felt like a bit of an hors d'oeuvre perhaps before tomorrow.
It did really, didn't it? Yes, stage 11 of the Vuelta to Farapona, a sort of modern classic in recent Vuelta history. We've seen Alberto Contador win there a few years ago. It's arguably where Chris Froome sort of broke through at the Vuelta in 2011 as well, isn't it? As Daniel explained last night. Anyway, no more waiting for David Godu to win his first Grand Tour stage. I think we should retire that pun now. We should retire it and never say it again.
Okay,
good. We had a showdown on the climb between the 2015 Tour de l'Avenir winner, Marc Soler, and the 2016 winner, David Godu. Soler, of course, already has a stage win in this Vuelta to his name, but he had no answer when Godu opened up his sprint for the line at the finish, and it was a really impressive stage win for the Frenchman, and also very well played by his team, Groupama FDJ, who had got his teammate Bruno Armirai into the break. To be fair, though, they weren't the only team that played the numbers game very well today, because Movistar had both Soler and Nelson Oliveira in the break, and Sunweb had the young riders, their Aussie Michael Storer and young British rider Mark Donovan in there as well. It was actually Tim Wellens of Lotto Soudal who kicked it all off right at the start of the stage. And although there was quite a bit of to and fro before the break got established, we had a strong group go clear with Armirai, Donovan, Storer, Oliveira, Wellens and Nicholas Egg of Trek in it before Godu and the King of the Mountains leader, Guillaume Martin, got across.
I mean,
and then
Lionel,
finally,
can I
Soler.
Say, he's good, isn't he, Nicholas Egg?
Goodness.
If we're not allowed waiting for Godu jokes, then we can have another dad joke. He's a good egg. Anyway, he's a good egg.
Goodness, goodness me. I mean, that's derailed me there. That really has.
Sorry.
Anyway, but the crucial thing was that Soler bridged across to that group when the break was a couple of minutes up the road. So that it was a strong ride from Soler to get across, and the peloton letting him go, which was also quite interesting. Surprisingly, Tim Wellens was then dropped, but that was us set for the day, really. And Jumbo-Visma, well, they had numbers all day, didn't they, on the front of the peloton, and they kept a reasonably tight leash on the break without ever really looking like they had incentive to completely do the whole job and catch them. So it was all decided on the final climb, and it was really one and done, wasn't it? One serious attack by Soler. Godu went with him, and then we saw them sprint it out for the line. Stora and Donovan took very impressive third and fourth places for Sunweb. Martin was fifth, but he has extended his lead in the King of the Mountains jersey by quite a considerable margin now. 50 points, I think, plays 24. Sepp Kuss is in second place. Behind all that, the GC race didn't really ignite, did it? Perhaps that was because of Jumbo-Visma's obvious strength. I don't know. We'll see whether they were waiting for tomorrow. Dan Martin, Enric Mas, Richard Carapaz and Primoz Roglic all finished together. Hugh Carthy lost a few seconds, seven to be precise. And so the top five is as you were, but Soler has moved up to sixth, 2 minutes 44 behind Roglic. Tomorrow it's the Angliru, one of the steepest climbs in World Tour cycling. And, well, even Dan Martin was saying before the start of today's stage that perhaps people would wait to see if they could make more gaps open up on that climb rather than today, which was quite a bit easier. But the Angliru awaits.
It is interesting, though, isn't it? Because there aren't all that many opportunities left in this Vuelta to make time. And of course, everybody's looking to tomorrow and they're, you know, the feared and revered Angliru, and they want to save their legs. But really, today, tomorrow, and then the time trial on Tuesday are some of the only opportunities to make up, you know, to make big gaps on your rivals. And I would not have raced the stage like that myself. And I really think today was a great opportunity for Jumbo-Visma to put Ineos in trouble, and everybody else as well. And I'm a bit gutted that they didn't do that, but they seem to have taken over the old Team Sky's way of riding, really, haven't they?
Well, the question I was going to ask you both was, are they making the same mistake they made at the Tour de France?
Yeah, I mean, it's a seconds game at the moment, and what they could have done today, over the course of this weekend, today and tomorrow, is they could have made minutes. If Roglic had the legs to make those big time gaps, today and tomorrow is where you're going to make them, and you're not going to have the opportunity to make those big time gaps. And we saw what happened at the Tour de France. If if it's too close, then you can lose it all in a time trial if something, or a crash or a puncture or, you know, something ill-timed, some misfortune. You want to take the opportunities when you can, and I don't really understand why you wouldn't take those opportunities today.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Thank you very much to iWalker for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. We've been hearing about iWalker and their charity bike ride from London to Brighton. Today, let's hear from James Turner, who really is the man behind the company's IT system. And it's been a very challenging year for him and everyone working in the IT department, with so many iWalker staff working at home instead of in the office. They've had to have their systems set up at home to be, accessible and secure. So let's hear from James about some of the challenges that the coronavirus crisis has thrown iWalker's way.
My name is James Turner. I'm the IT manager at iWalker, and I'm in charge of making sure that all of our dear iWalkans have the right tools and technology to get the job done as well as they can. Externally, I mean, everyone knows how tough it's been for everybody. We very quickly picked up on a sort of mantra within the department that we've moved from looking after three offices to 300. just to keep some perspective on how we go about our jobs. Obviously, everyone's house is different and everyone's setup at home is different. So we definitely had to upskill the team in how to sort of get around remote sort of household issues. We can't just sort of drop by people's desks anymore to fix a network issue. We needed to make sure we understand what the typical person will have in their home and how Wi-Fi works, and also introduce new problems for those people at home, in that normally they may have just used their Wi-Fi for using a tablet to browse while they were sitting in front of the television, whereas now they might be having to work out of a small back sort of closet room which had no Wi-Fi access. So we had to get quite creative and really sort of start working to make sure our staff had the skills and the facilities to get working productively.
If you'd like to find out more about iWOCA, go to iwoca.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk. We'll hear more from James tomorrow.
Well, it was a really excellent win by David Godou. We've been, we have been waiting for a big result from him. you know, he's a hugely talented writer. He's got a great finish. I remember him at Flesh Alone 2 or 3 years ago, almost winning it when he was, I think, a first-year pro. He was definitely a favourite for that finish with Marc Soler, especially after Soler had bridged across. And, I mean, once those two got away and Soler attacked first and Godou got up to him, I expected Soler, I wasn't sure whether Soler was riding for the stage or GC, because he's already got a stage win. And, you know, Movit, you said earlier, Lizzie, that Jumbo Visma perhaps didn't exploit their numerical advantage today. We'll talk about that again a bit later on. But, you know, Movistar have been doing that really well. And Soler gained a little bit of time back. He's up to sixth overall, 244 down. You know, I don't think he's going to be consistently up there, but they do have quite interesting cards to play with him and Valverde. But he did seem to be going for the stage win, and Godou really rinsed him in the end, didn't he? So a great victory for Godou. Shame we don't have Francois on tonight for a bit of French corner on Godou. But Michael Storer, Mark Donovan, third and fourth, two young Sunweb riders. Donovan's only 21, and a really good climber. And that's a great performance by him so early in his career. Sunweb, you know, they keep producing these riders, don't they? And riding in this interesting way, putting two riders in the break again. And I mean, I described it as a bit of an hors d'oeuvre for tomorrow's stage to the Angleroo. Well, let's hear from Nick Schultz, shall we, our audio diarist, because it's really interesting to hear what he says in the context of some of our comments already about the stage.
Stage 11, oof. An absolutely brutal day today, from kilometre zero to the end. Yeah, for sure the hardest day. We knew it was going to be really hard. It was an uphill start, which is always probably one of the most intimidating things as a cyclist, is an uphill start like that. So yeah, it took a little while for the break to go. It was super aggressive. A lot of people wanted to be in it. It finally went, and then Guillaume Martin missed it, but Tim Wellens was in there, and they've got a little battle for the KOM jersey, so Cofidis was straight to the front, kept it pretty close, and then on the first cut one climb of the day, about 40 odd k into the stage, it was on like Donkey Kong again, so that Guillaume Martin could get across and get some KOM points. So that climb was ridden full gas, came back, and just before the top a small group went away, which is ultimately the group that contested the stage win. It was also an eventful day for us. On the second last climb of the day, quite a tough one, Esteban punctured at a bad moment. The pace was sort of getting progressively quicker, so he punctured, got a wheel change. Callum, who was still there at that point, helped pace him a little bit, and then I dropped back and helped him back to the peloton. And at that moment there, that's spending a lot of energy for him at a really bad moment. So that was quite unfortunate. Just at the time of the race, it was super unlucky. which then led us into the final climb after a descent, and he was a little bit tired there, and then it was just a matter of pacing him up the finish climb to limit the losses. And tomorrow is another super hard day, and the race isn't over, so we'll continue with the same goal.
Very interesting to hear Nick Schultz's account of the day, and he made a big deal of the work that Cofidis did to keep the brake on a leash so that Guillaume Martin could bridge across. And I suppose that was as significant as the move later on from Soler to get across. Thinking about the finish, Rich, the race between Godu and Soler, I mean, Soler didn't have the legs when it really counted in the final 500 metres, but he had also, of all the riders in the break, he and Martin had probably made the biggest effort to get into it in the first place and perhaps paid for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's no surprise he looked pretty cooked after that effort to get over there, because he came over latest, you know, and then he had the shortest amount of time to recover from that effort, and it was a huge effort to get over there. And yeah, these are pretty hard climbs today, so I think he did a pretty good job. And he obviously made up time on GC, and he got a 6-second bonus on the line as well. And so to take him up into sixth is, it's a really great job. And then obviously he's got his teammate in fifth as well. So let's see what they can do tomorrow. I hope it would be nice to see one of them try and go for the podium rather than both of them try and get a menial top 10 result. Okay, yeah, of course, top 10 in a Grand Tour isn't a menial result, but you know what I mean? What's the point in being fourth and fifth if one of you could be third?
Don't forget Valverde. I mean, they've got three in the top 10.
Yeah.
And they are, you know, linking this to what you were saying earlier about Jumbo Visma, they are riding in a very aggressive way, Movistar. And I don't think they haven't got the firepower that Jumbo Visma have. And I'm wary of being too critical of the riders for not, in inverted commas, racing harder today. But you did say that it was perhaps an opportunity for Jumbo Visma to make their numbers count and use the fact they've got George Bennett still up there. And he probably does have more firepower than Valverde and Marc Soler.
I really think so. I mean, I mentioned this yesterday, and I really think it's a missed opportunity. And I know everybody's looking to tomorrow, but the thing is, you have to take the opportunity when it comes. And okay, yes, it's Roglic in the red jersey, and it's not Carapaz. But my director always says to us, if you want to get the rider out of their chair, you have to go and do something special. And you can't just sit and watch and wait for these riders to just win another race. If we just sit and watch and wait, then Annemiek's just going to go and win all of our races, because she is such a great rider and she is just so strong. So what you need to do is you need to go out there and you need to do something totally unexpected, and you need to take it to the other teams. And you can only do that if you've got the manpower. Jumbo-Visma have the manpower. I was kind of flicking on and off today because I was traveling, so I wasn't able to watch the whole stage live. And I flicked on when they were on the penultimate climb. And I think at that point, Froome was still there, and the bunch was massive. And I just thought, like, what are they doing? You know, Jumbo-Visma have got six riders here. Why don't they hit a tempo, drop the other riders, send off George Bennett? And they could have done that three climbs out. They could have sent him off miles out. They've really got nothing to lose, because what's the point in having him 3.5 minutes back on GC? Why don't you send him off? You've already put Ineos on the back foot by having him and having only Carapaz and Amador. Then yeah, you've still got six riders. You send off George Bennett. They're the ones that have got to do the chasing. And all the others like Martin and Hugh Carthy, they're just kind of sitting there, you know, not knowing what to do because they don't have any manpower to bring these riders back. And then suddenly you've got George Bennett in the virtual red jersey and everybody else wondering what to do. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's a missed opportunity. And I think that, you know, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Roglic is looking really, really, really strong. But if this race comes down to seconds on the final day again, and then somebody loses it because they have a mechanical, they're really going to regret not taking the opportunity today.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you, Lizzie, because, I mean, Farapona is a tough enough climb to make some more significant differences than we saw today. And, well, Carapaz had his last man with him was Dylan Van Baarle, and Van Baarle survived.
It was actually Amador.
Sorry,
final.
Sorry,
was the last. Yeah, but
Van Baarle was there for a long time. Though.
He was, but he was struggling. He was swinging for a long time.
Yeah,
and then Amador.
He was there, but not able to make the difference.
Amador went reasonably early too, but he's been carrying a big weight. Amador.
I totally agree. Like I said yesterday, he's doing everything for the team and he can't do everything for forever because, you know, when you do that day after day after day, you really start getting tired.
Well, yeah.
And you go so deep as a domestique, you really do. And then you don't recover because you still got to get to the top of the climb.
That's right. We saw Amador sort of 45, 50K to go with bottles down his jersey coming back up the group. All right, not from a huge distance that he'd had to drop back, but nevertheless, it's still an effort. And
really, if you're carrying bottles when you're going up a climb, that is so hard. A couple of extra kilos when you're, you know, when they're riding a tempo or kind of threshold up a climb, you don't underestimate how hard that is.
But yeah, I'm tempted to agree that Jumbo Visma, there's really no point having four or five riders still with Roglic with 4 or 5K to go on a climb like that. Really shred it down and put people on the back foot and really make it a race of Roglic against Carapaz, because at the moment it isn't as simple as that. There is a bit more to it. Dan Martin is a threat. Hugh Carthy, okay, hasn't looked brilliant on the last two finishes, but still close enough to be a threat. Enric Mas is quiet enough at the moment to think that you know, perhaps he's just been, you know, biding his time, maybe. Who knows? And Jumbo-Visma, with the Tour de France so recent in their memory, and when you think of how dominant they looked, and we all did feel that it was almost processional, wasn't it, Rich, from really quite early in the race, we didn't really start asking the question whether they'd done enough until it was too late.
Until the Planche des Belles Filles.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, the thing is, with a tactic like that, it is pretty extreme, and everybody's got to have the balls to say, yeah, I'm going to go for this. And the director has to have the balls, and so do the riders. And, you know, sometimes it's the director that comes up with it, and sometimes it's the riders. But if everybody's not behind it, it doesn't work. And the thing is, so often riders are scared, and directors are scared too, because they do not want to put everything on the line. And but yeah, if you don't put everything on the line, if you don't risk it all, then you don't make these huge gains.
But if you risk it all, you do risk losing a lot more than you
could
possibly gain.
You know what though, Richard, the penultimate two climbs today, they were both 9%. If you're going full gas and you're hurting, every single other person is hurting. You get absolutely no respite in the wheels. And all you're doing to the other riders around you is you are giving them one hell of a mental thrashing. They're like, oh my God, this team is going full gas and we're 60, 70K out. They must be so strong. I'm suffering. But because they're the ones on the back, they don't realize that the people in the front are suffering. You only see the back of the riders. You don't see their faces when they're absolutely swinging. You know, it's a mental game as well as a physical one. And sometimes the bravest man wins, but yeah, if nobody's brave, then you don't make the gains.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. For 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. SISCP25. I'll be stocking up for my Zwift ride tomorrow morning, Lionel, where I'll be joining you doing, where are we going tomorrow?
That's a good question. I think we're doing the London course and we'll be riding Box Hill. I mean,
well, good, excellent. Lizzie, just had a tweet from Brian Cookson, former UCI president, of course, in response to your tweet about visiting Preston bus station. He says, now this is what I call proper journalism. I am available to provide local expert comment. He's another Preston person we missed out of our list of distinguished Prestonians. But yeah, Brian Cookson is from there as well, isn't he? Lizzie, I have to say as well that I'm Richard. My name's Richard, and the other guy I'm the friendly Scottish one. And the other guy is Lionel. There was a bit of a mistaken identity in the last part.
I think I was getting so passionate about the need for Jumbo-Visma to race aggressively that I got confused, and I was thinking of Richard Plugger, which I actually got corrected a few seconds ago because I called him Richard Plug.
Well, that's all right, Francois. Don't you worry about it. Anyway, well, on with the stage. I was just looking down the list of finishes today for Ivan Soza. You know who should be up there. I mean, he's a good climber normally. 140.
Yeah, he was the last finisher for any of
36 minutes down. I mean, in the Gruppetto today, obviously something not right with him. We'll try and find out what. And Daniel's obviously on the ground there and may have an idea as well. But what's going on? But you know, Carapaz looks always very aggressive and dynamic on the bike, but he's not really being supported at the moment in the way that he would like. And it's funny, isn't it? Because we've come from the Giro where we saw such an impressive team performance from Ineos Grenadiers, and something sort of stark contrast to that here. It's interesting. But the other notable event today was the rider protest at the start, which seemed to be, it was about the, not so much the decision, but the deliberations taking so long after yesterday's stage to decide whether there was a gap that was, an actual gap in the front group yesterday, whether it was a stage that merited a 3-second gap, dictating whether there'd be a time difference between riders, i.e. the sort of ruling that we see on a flat stage, or just 1-second gaps between riders for time differences. And eventually they decided on the latter. And so the red jersey switched from Carapaz to Roglic. But the riders were, some riders were unhappy, and several teams staged a protest this morning led by Chris Froome. It broke down a bit, didn't it? But was the point made, do you think? Would the point have been heard?
I think the main point being made here is that the time taken to make the decisions, the lack of clarity, the confusion around the situation is unacceptable. You know, yesterday the decision was reversed and then reversed again. And then that's 2 days in a row that the live coverage has gone off air. And then, you know, commentators like us reporting on this race for the fans, we only found out who'd actually, you know, on the first stage, who'd actually won the race on the first stage, and then on the second day was in the red jersey. We only found out an hour later who it was. And so I really don't think that's acceptable that we don't even know that there's a jury deliberation taking place. If we understand, okay, the jury are deliberating this, it's going to take a certain amount of time, the results will come as soon as they can, that's fine. But there needs to be clearer processes. I explained the rules yesterday about why it's a 3 and 1 second gap. So please go back and listen to yesterday if you haven't already. But I think really, what Froome was complaining about was the fact that in the manual, it said that this was going to be, it was going to be applied as a mass sprint protocol day today, yesterday, sorry. And then they changed their mind. And in his eyes, that's not fair. And I do completely understand where he's coming from. But the other thing is that there is a rule, a UCI rule, that essentially says the commissaire's decision is final and the commissaire can make any decision that they want to. And I do actually think that that is an important rule, because there is always subjectivity. You know, often in cycling, things are never clear. And so it is important that the commissaires are and the jury are able to make a decision and it not be overruled in certain situations.
I'm not sure where I stand on that, really. Mike Woods made the point, didn't he, that they've been told before the start it was going to be 1 second, and then they were told at the start it was going to be 3 seconds, and then at the end, obviously, it ended up being 1 second. But should a decision not be taken, should the riders not be aware of what the rule is as they're racing? I understand the need for flexibility, but That seems like something that'd be quite simple. There'd be no recourse then to complain if you knew what the rules were before you start the stage.
I think it's difficult because you don't always know how it's going to finish. Like I said yesterday, I was always surprised that yesterday's stage was ever down as a mass sprint finish, because I just glanced at the course and I thought, oh, well, that's going to be small groups. And I do think that sometimes you maybe think it's going to be a small group finish and it ends in a bunch finish. Therefore, if you think it's going to be a 1 second protocol, then actually the 3 second mass sprint protocol needs to be applied. So it's the other way around. Really, the way it should be is that if it's a day where the 3 kilometer crash rule applies, then it should be the 3 second mass sprint protocol, and any other uphill finish or mountaintop finish, there should be no 3 kilometer crash rule, and there should be a 1 second rule applied. Yeah, that's the way I would do it if I was the race organizer.
Only a marathon.
I also know that the Vuelta deemed certain races to be certain stages to be mass sprint protocol stages, and the UCI actually overruled certain stages, but stage 10 wasn't one of those stages. Yeah. complicated issue.
But at the end of the day, the bottom line is that the whole issue could have been avoided if Richard Carapaz had been further up the road and not as far behind Primoz Roglic. And that is really the essence of bike racing. You know, if you're off the back a bit or a lot, then you're at the mercy of the regulations, the interpretation of the regulations, and the clock. And that is what stage racing is all about. And I think that really the way to avoid having an issue is to not finish that far behind. I mean, that's the whole point of the sport.
Yeah, I mean, of course, he was trying to be as high up as he could, and he got the gap, and this happened. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's actually probably better for the Grenadiers that they weren't in the red jersey today, because can you imagine if they had to take the front on a day like today? They, you know, he'd have been out of men.
Maybe that's why Jumbo Visma joined the protest this morning.
Yeah.
I mean, some relief, however, that Roglic has gone back into the red jersey from the green jersey, which many felt was clashing terribly with everything, really. And I wasn't a big fan of his green socks. He likes to match the socks with the jersey, doesn't he? And the green socks.
It was definitely a sartorial disaster with his yellow arm warmers and his green jersey.
And the gilet as well, with the, you know, when he puts the gilet over the top, which is also not even a standard Jumbo-Visma gilet, because it's his Slovenian champions one, which introduces even more colours. I mean, by the end, he was starting to look like a court jester.
Well, Dan Martin will wear the green jersey tomorrow. Roglic still has it by rights, but Martin went over, leapfrogged Richard Carapaz. And I think Martin looked pretty sharp today, and he should enjoy the Angleroo, shouldn't he? I think he could go well tomorrow.
No, he's having a great Vuelta, and it's really great to see him, yeah, performing at the highest level. And well, apart from his little crash earlier in the, I can't remember which stage it was, when the stage Roglic won, when he had a little tumble, but thankfully was on the same time. But yeah, apart from that, he's not had any misfortune so far. So I wish him no misfortune in the rest of the race, because so often that has been his downfall, really. And yeah, I think he's really got the legs, and I hope tomorrow he's going to have a good day. But he's seemed infallible so far.
What one thing I wanted to just note was that I thought Asturias, we were in, weren't we today, looked absolutely beautiful. And one thing that always surprises me about the Vuelta, although it shouldn't now, is just the, you know, the fact that these big mountains exist outside of just one or two mountain ranges, which is more the case in France and Italy, perhaps. You know, the mountain ranges are very famous. In Spain, you've got these huge climbs just dotted all over the place, and I thought the countryside today looked absolutely spectacular. The light was beautiful. They've been blessed by reasonable weather, haven't they? There haven't been the questions for the Vuelta that there were at the Giro about whether the weather might have an impact on whether
the Roglic almost lost the race by not being able to get his rain jacket
There was that day, yes. But generally, I mean, today looked great, and it looked lovely. Sure.
I would have to agree with you. It's definitely fueled my desire to go and ride along the north coast of Spain. And I do love this autumnal evening light that you're getting on the end of every stage, and the way it kind of lights the winners' faces as they cross the line every day. It's really quite beautiful. And I'm not sure the peloton will be keen to move any of the Grand Tours into the autumn next year, but it's really nice to have something a little bit different. And it feels quite special in what's been a very difficult and challenging year so far.
It's the Vuelta of the long shadows, and it does look nice, definitely. Well, the Angleroo, Richard, have you ever been there?
I have not, Lionel.
Ah, it's.
I know you have. I mean, you've You flicked somebody, didn't you? Fran Reyes, was it, to get in a car?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they laid on the organisers.
In a car, I was going to say.
Well, hang on. They laid on. The organisers were laying on a sort of minibus to take journalists from the press room, which was down in a town, probably about 5 or 6K from the bottom of the Angliru up to the top. But veterans of covering the Vuelta had tipped me off that basically what happens is they set off in the bus and then get maybe a third of the way up the climb when the gradient really starts to bite. And then they kind of create some kind of drama and they give the journalists the option of either getting out and walking to the top or staying in the bus and going back down to the press room. No intention of taking the minibus up sort of 21-22% gradient because basically, not to put too fine a point on it, a minibus wouldn't make that. So we were all dumped out and we had to walk. It was really quite a long way, probably about 5 or 6K up the Angliru. But it gave me a real impression of just how steep it is in places. But I did manage to just break away from Fran Reyes, who was covering the Vuelta with us on that occasion. And
I found this section on this in our book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year.
Here we go.
By the Cycling Podcast. Here we are. I decide I have to be in the early break. So I set off with barely a glance over my shoulder. We may be teammates, me and Fran, but it's every man and woman for themselves now. I leave him laughing and chatting and, I think, eating a biscuit. Apart from wishing that I also had a biscuit, I have no regrets. I stride up a very steep section and realise it's going to take me a long time to walk to the top. Up ahead, I see a woman pleading with the passing vehicles to give her a lift. She's having no luck until she decides to walk in the middle of the road, which forces the next vehicle, a small white van covered in Vuelta logos, to stop behind her. She waves her accreditation at the driver. The driver shakes his head, but she's not taking no for an answer and manages to open the back door of the van before he can drive off. Noticing there's room for a not-so-small one, I get in too. Where's Fran? Who knows? Who cares? I am Warren Bargeel. He is Wilco Kelderman. I've got ages to get my story straight. There we go. A shocking moment in the history of the Cycling Podcast. But you got there. You got to the top.
I did get there. Fran got there in the end as well. I know not how, but we all made it to the top of the Angliru.
Is every bit as spectacular as it looks?
It is, yeah. It is ridiculously steep. It's on the it's steeper than the Mortirolo, isn't it? In places, I think it is one of the steepest climbs in the World Tour. I mean, it's like the Mur de Huy, but it's a proper mountain. It's not just a kilometre climb out the back of Huy at the end of Flèche Wallonne. It's it's spectacular, and it does sort out the riders, doesn't it? We may well see some gaps open up tomorrow.
Well, the last time the race went up there, who finished second on the stage, Lionel?
Wout Poels.
Could he be the man tomorrow? Who knows?
No.
oh, there we go.
Sorry.
you're probably right, Lizzie, but
we tried to inject a bit of suspense into proceedings.
Yeah, thanks for that. I hope he's not listening.
He won't be listening.
Well, you'll be thanks for that as well, Lizzie. Oh my goodness. Late substitution for tomorrow. Lizzie, thanks very much for joining us again. You will be joining us again tomorrow night, won't you?
I will be indeed. Looking forward to the fireworks. And I have to say, I didn't give Movistar enough credit. They have been putting on a show for everybody. So yeah, not quite sure what they're doing. Maybe they're just really cementing that team classification, but I have been enjoying their riding. So yeah, I will see you tomorrow when hopefully we have a lot of attacking to talk about.
Well, thank you, Lizzie. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Lizzie.
You're just creating more suspense there, Lionel. Que nos vamos de...